Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Carulla and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Wake up, Hollywood. This is Nikki Carulla, your host with the most. Eddie Pence is doing a comedy show tonight, so we're just going to jump right in. We've got graphic and visual artist Anthony Malzone. Say hello, Anthony.
Hello, everyone. How you doing?
Look, the studio audience loves you already.
Oh, man.
You see that? A little dramatic pause, and then you can just
great crowd.
Cut them off, just like that. They're so obedient.
Yeah.
So, you know what? You've been doing some cool stuff. We're going to jump right in. Anthony, you and I met going to the gym.
Crazy story, huh?
Randomly, I was wearing a Prince shirt.
Yeah.
And you came up to me and you were like, dude, I designed that shirt. And it's actually one of my favorite Prince shirts. And talk to me a little bit about that shirt for a second, because I was thinking about it all day today. I was like, man, that shirt is such a cool design. It's a picture of Prince with like a peacock feather look of his ticket stubs for the Musicology tour, right?
Yeah, it's a pretty meta vision. So I was seeing you from across the gym, and then you had the Prince shirt on of him wearing a shirt that I designed. Yeah, so...
Wild.
It's crazy. So those were like one-offs that I made for him. And I was working with him probably for about, I think, 4 or 5 years.
Unbelievable.
And it was just supposed to be a one-off project, just to work on his website. And it eventually got bigger and bigger. I finally had to quit my day job, and I had a ton of stuff to do. And it was anything from fashion design, set design, album cover design. I went to his house in Paisley Park. I mean, it's the mecca of music, you know? So it's not just a house. I mean, it's just a house of music. So
I remember I was telling you, I was like, man, you got to do the Paisley Park tour. And you're like, dude, I was there and he was opening the door. I'm like, yeah. Oh. You just totally beat my story no. by 1,000%.
But going back to those shirts, like he would request, these turtleneck designs, because he'd have like this template made. So I had the template there, and he would come to me and be like, "Oh, I really want to have like these like flaming lips in this really cool room," and he'd give me just very light direction. And from there, I was able to have a lot of creative freedom and just go off and do, you know, 5 or 6 versions of whatever that, like, initial direction was. So with that shirt, that's one of the rare times that he actually sent me a photo and was like, let's tweak this and put, a little filter on it. And that shirt that was on, that you were wearing, it actually became...
It's hung up in Paisley Park.
It's crazy. That actually became also a design for a guitar as well. So I did like a few tricks to it. I just did a few inversion tricks and did a different layout so it actually would look presentable like on the chest, because I think I just rotated it like 90 degrees. And then he liked that so much that he eventually made a guitar of it. And
that's so wild.
It was crazy.
What a compliment. I mean, seriously.
Yeah, no, like I said, this was never a project where I had to apply. It wasn't anything that I really, really asked for and wanted. It was a good friend of mine who I still work with today. And it was his sound engineer friend who's like, you know, I've been doing a lot of work with Prince, and he's looking to release some new albums, and he wants a site designed. It's like, do you know anyone who's good and who can handle that? And at the time, it was 2009. I was just asked on a side gig, you know, like, hey, I know you're doing some stuff like during the day, but can you come over at night and like just we'll talk about this project? And he wouldn't tell me who the musician was.
Wow.
You know, so the whole thing, I was like, you know, I'm just...
Were you a Prince fan before this?
I was a fan of his music, but I never got to appreciate how good he was until I finally saw him live.
Yeah, that's always the case with everybody.
Oh my gosh.
He's insane.
it's crazy. Like, I now look at him as though he's like the, you know, Mozart and Beethoven of our generation.
Totally. Absolutely. And the way he played. It's just incredible.
And the amount of instruments that he played. You know, and he mastered, you know, he's like one of the few artists that have been on Drum Magazine, yep, cover, Guitar Magazine. I mean, you can just, Bass Magazine. I mean, he can play everything. And, you know, I actually saw him once ever at his house playing, you know, with one hand on the guitar, like, you know, on the frets there, and then on the other hand on the keyboard.
Jeepers.
At the same time. It was mind-blowing.
And you're just like,
like, how does that, the brain,
should I
like,
sell tickets
then
for this,
go back to this, to the guitar, the keyboard? And it was nuts.
And did he take you around to all of his little areas in the house?
Yeah, it was massive. The house that we went to was, it was like around, was in the Mulholland area, and it was 77 Beverly Park. So it's really weird how even his love of the number 7 was like also in his address.
That's crazy.
But that house was incredible. So I remember the first time I went to that house, we talked for hours, and it wasn't even about music. I mean, the guy can go on politics, on, like, you know, comedy, on nature, on photography, on anything. And we finally went just to talk about the site, like, maybe, you know, like the third hour. And then here's the craziest thing is that we finally went downstairs after just vibing, you know, for a bit. And then we go down this long corridor, and way at the end was his drummer, John Blackwell.
Oh, my God. He's my favorite.
And John was just...
And he just passed recently.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's tragic because he's a great man, great musician. And it was John Blackwell just sitting at the drum set, just waiting for Prince to come down to, like, jam again.
That is unbelievable.
Like, you have more discipline and patience than anyone I've ever met in my life.
That's crazy.
Yeah, and he had a wine cellar down there. He had the Purple Rain motorcycle there. He had a theater downstairs. It was insane.
You're like, this is
personal
a
chef.
Whole different way of living.
No, it wasn't real. So actually, after working with Prince, I had to, like, know that this wasn't going to be an everyday thing. This is like a special time in my life that I'm never going to forget. It's just going to be an incredible experience that I'm just going to take with me forever. But to work with a musician of that caliber is...
That's amazing.
It doesn't happen.
No. I mean, you know what? There aren't many musicians in the world like him.
No.
Ever.
And you know, he always would say, "Real music by real musicians." You know, and the industry, the whole, and as you're a musician yourself,
yeah,
you know,
I
the whole landscape
the
is changing, like,
yep,
180. And we need, you know, cello players. We need people who are playing the violin. We need people who are playing the guitar more than any other time.
I agree.
It's crazy.
I totally agree.
So,
yeah. I remember you were talking about he had weird hours. Like, you wouldn't start at, like, 9 a.m. or 10 a.m., like, maybe noon, you know what I mean? You would start in weird hours. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I would fly out to Paisley Park during the summer of 2009 quite often. It was actually the transition from Lotus Flower from 2009 up until 2010. And I would fly in that morning, check in to my hotel in Chanhassen, and, you know, that was around maybe like 2 or 3 o'clock. And I settled down for, like, you know, an hour, but then I had to get ready, and we'd start work around 4 p.m.
That's, like, when most people's work days end. Now, your work day, too, I mean, you're an artist, but, like, you're pretty conventional, I'm sure, with your hours. So, like, starting your day at 4 p.m., that's definitely a change.
Absolutely. I mean, luckily, the place where I work now, you know, we start late, but we also work late, you know, so
right,
it kind of all evens out. But, you know, working with Prince, like, he was just such a night owl that, you know, really, oh, I got to tell you also this, another story about that is that when I was there, he would be working on the music, but the music was divided with the people who were jamming. So he'd have, like, the drummer, the bassist, and the guitarist in one room in the main soundstage, right?
Right.
And then he would go down and he'd work with the vocalists, you know, and then they would be in another room. And then he would come into my room where I was working on the computer, and then he would be giving me direction and checking up on updates, and he would be doing that circle all within Paisley Park, but he would be going from one session to the next, just kind of sprinkling his wisdom on, like, you know, is everything in the right direction? Are we still on point? For about until, like, the sun came up.
That is crazy.
He wouldn't stop from 4 p.m. till, like, the sun came up. And I remember I'd just leave, come back to L.A., exhausted.
Yeah, I bet.
He used to just wipe people out just to because he wouldn't stop. You know, he lived in music, and he knew, I guess, that, you know, he just was there to constantly be creating.
I heard he recorded Kiss, for example. He didn't eat. He just drank water. He did a little cocaine, but he did it for 3 days. He didn't do anything but just record that song. So, like, I could see that his hours were crazy because he's just in the moment of creating all the time.
Especially being in a place like Paisley Park where music is all around you and you have, you know, you can walk down the hall and be, like, in a recording studio and then you can go to the main sound stage. I mean, he lived in the atmosphere of music, so he basically was just, like, almost like a really crazy dedicated coworker, just crashing at work under the table or somewhere here just to, like, I want to just wake up and be there. I don't want to have to worry about driving there. I don't have to worry about, like, getting my food and dry cleaning. It was all just handled on site.
That's incredible.
It was nuts, man.
So let me ask you this, too. When you're sitting there working with Prince and he's looking at, like, a draft of something, first of all, you got to be nervous because that's just crazy. You're having one of the best artists in the world of all time looking at something that you're designing for him. You know what I mean? So it's like... Yeah. You showing him stuff, like, what was the first thing that you showed him?
It was chicken scratch on a piece of paper.
Wow.
Because it was the first time I met him that one night, I left the first night I met him with the album as burned to a CD to take home with me.
Just
the crazy thing was, like, I actually had the latest Prince album before anyone, even before it was finally mastered and mixed.
Amazing.
So, I mean, I was there at such a time when he's like, you know, it's right about done. I'm ready to go ahead and, like, start, you know, mastering it, and then I just need to find someone to distribute it. But being able to show him my artwork, I was always so comfortable because I was able to see things from his music. I was able actually to listen to that album, especially from the get-go, because if you listen to Lotus Flower, the opening track, it's like you're traveling down this portal and you're going through space, and it's very psychedelic and it's very visual, even though it's music. Like, I can see that. And the second that I started hearing that, I started sketching when he was just right in front of me. And I was just, and Scott and I, my good friend who actually got me the gig, we were just going back and forth, and I'm like, you know, we can kind of have this galaxy where you go from planet to planet, and then each planet was an album. And I showed him it, and I think, like, he saw it and was like, okay, I kind of get what you're saying, but, like, yeah, just show me the final version. But I don't think it didn't make any sense to him just yet. But I remember the first time he's like, we got to continue working together, is right before New Year's Eve of 2008, going to 2009, I sent him the album cover. I sent him what would be, like, the starting hub of this website, and little did I know that became the album cover. But I was just putting it in a mock-up. So I have all these, like, templates as a designer.
Right.
You have, like, you know, oh, here's, like, for a bottle of water. Like, here's, like, you know, a new wine bottle template, and they're all blank. So I had this CD shell template, and I just put it in there, and I mocked it up as though I picked three tracks, and I highlighted it just as though it's, like, singles. And I try to make it look as real as possible. And I was like, here's your product that you've been working on. Like, here it is in the actual, like, framed cover. And within, like, 5 minutes, he got back to... you could tell he was just waiting for the artwork to be delivered. He was on his machine and said, we got to start. When can we do this? Like, when can we get this moving?
Wow.
Within, like, 5 minutes.
And you're just like, this is crazy.
Yeah, it was nuts. That's when I knew it was actually going to be... It could be a bit more than just the website.
And for his website, like, was he kind of, like, hands-on about how he wanted things looking? What did he... I mean, I'm sure every musician or any person that's worked with him always says he asked for something extravagant, sometimes things that aren't even possible. Did he do any of that?
Yeah, I mean, almost everything needed to be done, like, the day before. Like, that was the mentality. It's like, no, we need to get moving fast and... Like you were saying, he asked me to do things like about, you know, 90% of the work that I did for that first year I'd never done before.
Really?
So honestly, he would ask me for, like, you know, I never did an album cover,
right,
a proper one. And two,
right.
another thing too is we were racing against the gun to deliver everything to Target, because that was an exclusive release. So we not only did we had a do an album cover, but it was like a booklet, and it had a 3-album release because he also had Minneapolis Sound.
That's right.
And he had his protege, Bria Valente. And so that was like a whole package. And I was like, you know, you get the CD template from the printer, and then, you know, they're all just squares, and you got to figure out how it folds. And I was, and then I had to get it. Actually, we got it done on the first try. Like, everything finally was sent through.
That
but it
is
was
crazy.
Just nuts, man. Yeah, and then it became just bigger requests. It was like, can you, you know, design a... I did so much artwork that we're like, okay, let's find a place where we can put it. So he, you know, he would wear some of the stuff. He'd want it printed. We made some stuff into sets. But
like, what was the set that you did?
Oh, it was crazy. So I remember giving him the concept for the 3 album covers, and then he like sat there at his desk, and he opened up the box set, and he saw the left panel, the right panel, and the back, and he was actually holding it up, looking at it like it was
a stage.
Like you were the fourth wall, and he was looking at it like a stage. So he was like, okay, cool, like every wall is basically an opportunity to promote an album, and that was for Jay Leno.
That is crazy.
But no, like when you were asking about like his direction and in terms of like creative vision, he did loosely like he let me have a lot of creative freedom.
That's awesome.
But like if I wasn't hitting the mark, I would have to like I would freak out and know like, you know, because usually if he wanted something, he liked it, approved like really quick. But if I didn't hear back from him, that's when I'd freak out. I'm like, oh, he doesn't like it.
So he wouldn't tell you he didn't like it.
Yeah, it was really weird. I just wouldn't get a response back.
And so would he expect you with that non-response just to fix it?
I think he knew that I'm just very hard on myself as an individual. So usually I would hear such good feedback because he needed stuff really fast.
Right.
So if he needed it really fast and he didn't say it was approved or let's do it, then I knew I had to go back to the drawing board.
Wow.
But he was amazing with layout. Like, we were doing the... it didn't actually become a thing, but there was going to be a lyrics booklet. And he was amazing at layout. So he would see, like, some photography that he shot, and he'd be like, okay, well, that's some negative space right here, so let's go and let's put some of the lyrics there. And then, you know, once they flip the page, that kind of will lead in... That last image will lead into this, and it will kind of link these songs together. And I was like, dude, this is crazy.
Like, I don't even see that.
I know. I don't even see it. And then I realized he was a photographer and, like, you know, he loved taking photos. And, I mean, the guy was just multi-talented.
Dude, he was just, he's on that level that few ever reach.
Oh,
you know what
gosh.
I mean? Well, let's go way back. Yeah. What got you into wanting to be an artist, wanting to create? What was the moment of Zen? That's what we call it on Wake Up Hollywood.
Wow. I remember... My mom was always a big fan of my artwork. Like, I would always sketch and just do, like, little doodles, and she's my biggest fan, you know? So she would always make sure, like, you know, like, she would just see, like, the positives of things that still needed work, but it was, like, you had potential to, you know, to really take this further. But I remember after high school, and I applied to college, and I didn't, you know, I was somehow on this path of, like, my dad is an artist, my grandfather's an artist, I actually enjoy it. Like, I'm actually ready for all the, you know, crazy stuff that might happen of people critiquing your work. That there almost was, like, never a plan B. It was always like, I'm going to do it. And I think I could do this for the rest of my life.
So you were in high school.
Yeah, yeah. It was really weird. Even before I even had my first job or internship, I was like, I'm going to do this, you know?
That's amazing.
It really was something that, you know, I haven't been too sure about many things in life, but that was like
one
of them.
Well, it's a calling. It's like a calling. It kind of taps you on the shoulder. It's like, you know, you come over here and do this.
Yeah, and I guess because my parents, you know, my mom, she worked so many hours and did many, many different things. My dad was an artist at the newspaper, and my grandfather was a painter who worked at the Metropolitan Opera House.
Wow.
He's just an incredible artist and also just a guy with amazing landscaping skills. Like, you know, he designed the backyard of where we grew up, and, like, you know, he brought a lot of traditions from Italy over to, like, the Bay Area where my family grew up.
What part of Italy are you from?
a place called, my grandfather's from a place called Agnone,
okay,
which is in the region south of Salerno, and it's the Amalfi Coast, essentially, yeah, like right around,
yeah,
there.
Like Positano, Amalfi, exactly. Yeah, yeah, that's a beautiful part of Italy.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
Man, you need to move back, dude.
I know, it was incredible. But yeah, I just always felt comfortable in the space of creation, and I feel like, you know, like I was always given support, and it just felt comfortable, and I knew that like college was my time to like make mistakes and also like
right.
try new things. And I was like, towards the end, I realized that I'd put so much into it that it never really felt like it. I never really felt like it was a strenuous. It never felt like it was. I had to go to this class. It just felt literally fluid. Like I was in the right.
Did you
place.
Experiment with different mediums, like because graphic design versus like painting on a canvas? They're like similar and they're totally different. So like, how do those kind of, you know, change or shape your art form?
Well, my grandfather always told me like, you know, before you learn how to paint, you have to learn how to draw. So like, he never really taught me how
I
to
got
paint.
Chills.
That's yeah, awesome. Yeah, it was cool. It was all about like the fundamentals.
Right.
And I remember just going from college, and then I went into animation. So my first like, you know, kind of way of like, here's what I'm comfortable about the computer is like, but can you also like draw it and like put it in motion,
right.
You know? And that was kind of scary for me. But my mom was like, yeah, you're never too old to like start something new. I felt like I was behind because I was actually getting into animation my sophomore year of college. And all my friends who were actually, you know, who were taking animation or were already on animation 2 and 3. And, you know, they're doing their like, you know, midterm final. And I was like, man, I got to start from the beginning. And that's something, too, for other artists out there, is that, like, that timeline is kind of just rubbish.
It's an illusion.
It's an illusion.
Total illusion.
Because all the people that I know that I really looked up to don't even do animation anymore.
Wow, really?
Well, let's just say this. No, there are a few people that I think in that class that I really looked up to. A few of them have done it. But the people who I thought, oh, these guys are going to be, like, the people I really want to model myself out of, no, they're maybe doing video editing, you know? And I was like, yeah, just to kids everywhere, like, you know, it's never too, like my animation teacher said, it's never too late till you're dead. And I was like, man, you're right. You know, and you can go and have all these great degrees, but what's good if you don't use them?
Well, you look at somebody like Picasso. He's, like, one of my favorite artists. And his biggest works weren't necessarily when he was in his 30s and 40s. His biggest works were in his like 60s, you know what I mean? His 70s, like, so, you know, he was always struggling. I've been watching this great series on National Geographic. It's a series on Picasso, and it just shows all the stages of his life and how certain cycles parallel his youth versus old age. But it's exactly what you said. It's like there is no timeline. About like trying to outdo yourself or break the rules as much as you can.
Absolutely.
And also adapt to old traditions and know what the techniques are so that you can innovate too.
So you can break the rules.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. You know, I feel like, you know, that whole thing about going through theory and, you know, it all kind of goes, it's great to have, but it, you know, a lot of times you're always pose challenges as an artist, like,
right.
How can I overcome this, or, you know, I gotta get this to work, you know, and get this, you know, circle to go into the square peg, whatever, you know. So you have to be clever, and you gotta just find ways and just not quit, because it's a tough industry too.
I think one of the craziest things that you have to deal with are like Pantone colors
for print.
Dude,
yeah,
that
actually
is,
I'm glad I don't have to deal with print.
Insane.
That is crazy.
Well, even just getting your colors to be what they need to be. Like, you have to, like, if you create an image, somebody can mess it up that, you know, doesn't know the same kind of Pantone colors that you're using. Like, I learned all this working on my own records, having graphic designers send me stuff, and the printers asking me questions. I was like, wait a minute, what?
Yeah.
Like, it's orange. No, no, it's not orange. It's got to be these 450 oranges. One of them is the right one. I'm like, what? So, like, how do you deal with translating your art into becoming what you envision it to be through those processes, especially when somebody else can get involved?
Right. Yeah, well, especially like as a musician, I'm sure that there's so much can go wrong from even the recording phase to like the mixing to final. I mean, a guy can just mess up on that final export.
Oh yeah,
of a song, you know, like, and it's like so many things. Like 10 things went right, but that 11th export. Oh, we have to just go and do this little small tweak, and that kind of
happens all the time.
Yeah, so that whole pipeline is like coming up with a good workflow is really important. And then now that I'm working in a studio with the creative agency of other designers, like that's, it's really important to have like a solid workflow. So say for instance, if we're doing a piece for a video edit that we're doing, we'll have like the storyboards done first. And then from there, we'll go into the rough edit. And before we even do any motion graphics or any sort of like, you know, all the bells and whistles that go on a piece, you want to make sure the timing's right. You want to make sure the story's told properly. And then from there, then you can have the motion graphics guy, you know, put his touch on it. And then from there, there's like sound mixing done and then the final export. But like kind of always checking up that these stages are actually running like on par as they're supposed to be. That's the constant work of like, you know.
Well, it's also deadlines too. The deadlines aren't always going to be right on the money, you know what I mean? Because some things you don't really see. It's kind of like whenever anything artistic is involved, the art will tell you when it's done. You can't tell it when it's done.
I know,
you know,
right?
What I mean? It's like you can't control that. So,
like, when's the piece finished?
Right.
You know?
Right. So is that kind of one of the obstacles that you also deal with digital work or, you know, anything you're doing design-wise?
Yeah, that's... I always feel that I have to hold back a lot because, you know, I was never afraid of a blank canvas. Like, you know, a lot of people freak out if they're, like, you know, draw something, you know, and they freak out because there's nothing there. You know, but I feel like I always try and do like, you know, maybe 5 or 6 things that, you know, are just icing on the cake that's sometimes not needed. I'm always trying to actually learn how to pull back and realize that like the simplest execution is sometimes probably the best way to go about it, because I can over-design something. And I try every time I'm starting a project is to just really like have an objective, like really what do I want to get out of this thing, because, you know, what's the goal and the end product? Because if you don't, then you're just like going through hoops and it gets crazy.
And you got a couple things like kind of going right now. You were working on Pacific Rim Uprising. Talk a little bit about that. And you have a TV show that you're starting to work on in development. So talk a little bit about both those projects.
Yeah, but before I get into that, you mentioned Picasso on National Geographic.
Yeah.
So National Geographic is one of our clients that we work with.
That's amazing.
And we actually did the opening 15-second teaser to Picasso.
What?
Yeah.
Seriously?
Yeah. And it was, you know, in the industry like that, like you get to get a project if it's on the, like, you know, beginning stages of it. Like, you want to entice the filmmakers that maybe that social campaign is on the right track. So we were asked to, like, you know, let's think of like just the brushwork of Picasso, and then let's see if we can kind of just, you know, open the piece with like these great brush strokes, and
I
you're
love
focusing
that
on the texture of like, the paint on the canvas.
Yeah.
So we actually did this, you know, shoot where we shot canvas, and then we I went on with the iPad Pro, and I was able to go ahead and do like these brush strokes, and then from there we made a bump map of like the light and dark values of the brush stroke. And then my friend went in and made a texture from that in 3D.
That's
and then
wild.
Basically the texture was reacting to the light and dark values of that. And it was actually like whenever there was like, I think it was the whites or the blacks, whatever would react to light, if it was the whites and the highlights, then that's what would actually like look as though it was thicker than the other parts of the brush where it didn't get as much paint.
I know exactly
so,
what you're
talking
about.
And it looks beautiful. If you go up to a painting, like, and you see an oil canvas painting, I mean, it's amazing just the texture of that organic brushwork. So that's what we did initial pitch, and then you finally pulled out and you're able to see it was like Antonio Banderas like playing Pablo Picasso.
Dude, that is wild. Man.
Yeah.
And I'm such a huge fan of the show just because everything about it's artistic.
Oh yeah!
Like you see the stories, the way they do the intros, everything. So, dude, that's amazing.
And it's funny,
and I'm not surprised because you do great work.
Oh, thank you very much. And it's funny that it's almost like the art is like the icing on the cake because he lived such a crazy lifestyle, you know,
right?
Very passionately, you know, lifestyle. So, it's cool to see that stuff. But with what I do now, it's actually working with the same guy who I worked with Prince. You know, like he started his own creative agency, and I went and dabbled in fashion, and fashion just became very pricey and expensive.
Right,
so
right.
I was like, before I go broke, I want to actually see what I'm really good at and go after that, because I think as an artist, you can have an ego and just go until, you really put all your eggs in one basket. And I was like, I like fashion. I want to continue, but I don't want to base my career and make or break it just yet.
Right,
right. It's a big risk. So I went back to doing what I really love to do. We do a lot of social media work. So what we did for Pacific Rim Uprising is we handled the social campaign for them.
Amazing.
And that was huge. And we got that project because, one, we understood the property really well. We're fans of science fiction.
Right.
It's really important because there's so many people working in the industry,
that don't know the market.
That aren't even fans of movies, it's crazy. But we're big nerds and we pride ourselves on that stuff,
Right.
So sci-fi to us is like our second language. So we did this whole Jaeger Academy. So it was you being a young trainee and a cadet and going through the ranks, and in that process you'd get to have your identification badge. So it was essentially extending the experience of the movie onto social media. So you felt like you're a part of it. And it just made sense because it was, they had this Jaeger Academy in the movie and it was all a bunch of cadets and oh, that's cool. Like for social media, you can go and design your own custom Jaeger and name it. And, we had a precision and judgment game. So we basically run in line with the movie. We want to extend the experience to fans, get them excited and share it with their friends so they go and tune in and watch it. And that's essentially what we do. But we got to be really good storytellers and be true to the story and make sure that we have the same vision that the director has and that the movie studio has. But before that, we worked on Kong Skull Island.
Oh yeah,
and that was
a great movie.
It was awesome to work on. Yeah, it was fantastic, and that's done with a group of individuals in a company called Legendary, and they're probably the best people to work with because they take a lot of pride in the small details that really make a movie.
Right.
Because,
and they're in-house, in the country, U.S.?
Yeah, no, they're actually just down the street. They're over right by Universal Studios, right in the area on Barham, when you just kind of make that that right curve. But they have people who are, really passionate about creating these worlds. So before we even got to, diving into the campaign, we understood about, here's Skull Island, here's where it is on the map, and here's the weather system that happens in this island, and here are the creatures and here are the plants that exist, and this is something that's almost like Darwin's island where the Galapagos, only certain creatures exist here, and it's a balance of myth and science. And it was so much fun to work on that project.
It must have been amazing.
And
you need to put that on your resume. Because I was reading your resume. I'm like, I already know he's done way more than what he just sent me. But you know what? Those are really cool eggs to sit, kind of be surprised with. So that's an amazing accomplishment.
Man. Yeah, it's a lot of fun to work on those. And it's fun to also have the variety of being, working with Warner and Universal, and we did some stuff with Netflix. So it's a wide variety of work. So we're not just doing sometimes
one thing.
Imagine if you're just on a movie it'd be great to own that. But I'm sure there's people by the end of the movie that are just kind of burnt out.
Right, of course, because once it doesn't fascinate you or become innovative or ever changing. Then you're just doing that. You're just tracing lines. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Which is what we don't want to do as artists.
Mm-mm.
I wanted to ask you, with the social media campaign and even with Kong Skull Island, how do you gauge? Do you gauge a response from an audience? Are you gauging your response between the people that you're working with on this, on the final product? Because art is so subjective. Even when you create something, you may be criticizing it when you're looking at it, that things that we're not seeing, as the layman when it comes to some of that stuff. So how do you gauge that response? Do you get it from the audience's response? Do you get it from the people that you're working with? Do you get it from somebody else that's trying to take credit for it? I don't know who it is,
That's a good question. I base it off of two things. One is fan reaction. you know, what are people talking about from the movie? Are they getting really excited about these moments that we really want to, like, tease out to the audience?
Right.
And we do a lot of social listening, too. So the Happy Time Murders is something that just came out this last week, and it's this buddy cop movie where there's puppets and humans coexisting in L.A., and the fans so far have just loved it. And what we'll do is we'll also, you know, we'll listen to the fans and we'll respond back to them. And we'll give them, like, you know, cool reaction gifts, or we'll, you know, we'll kind of take their comment and we'll put a little, you know, a fun, like, sarcastic or sassy, you know, remark that's done in good taste, you know. But right. just to, like, talk within the tone of the film and to actually, you know, have their excitement, be like, you know, we're fans, you're just as much of fans of the medium as you guys are, you know, like, we get excited too when this stuff comes out. So one is definitely, is the community really reacting to this well? And if we're listening to a lot of stuff, you know, we'll actually retweet stuff from the fans just to, like, that makes their day, you know.
Right.
It's huge,
right. Well, because they think they're part of the creative process, which at the end of the day, we all would love to be, you know what I mean?
Exactly. Absolutely. And that the brand is also listening. You know, like, that's really cool that you actually care about what the fans, you know, are talking about. And then it also comes down to, are the clients happy, you know, and are they happy with, you know, some, it does come down to numbers, and, you know, they have a budget, and it's nice to make sure that they meet them, and sometimes they don't, you know.
Well, the hard thing with being an artist, too, it's like, you know, people that may hire any artist to do something, they may not know the vocabulary, they may not have the vision. And sometimes you're creating and bending the work to match this limited perspective. You know what I'm saying? It's it's like a very, it's one thing to work with a prince, you know, like you, somebody that has artistic vision.
Right.
But it's a whole different thing to work with somebody that may not have an artistic bone in their body. And it's like, how do you gauge balancing what you know is best versus what they think they want?
You know? Yeah. I mean, with Prince, I mean, like you were saying, like, he had, a really clear vision. He knew what he wanted. There are some clients that will come to us, and they actually, that's probably a good thing, because they a lot of times that we also, on that end, we don't want to actually be told, you know, here's, everything's been kind of decided. We just need to have you execute it. So sometimes when they don't really know, like, exactly which path they want to go down, it's nice to actually bring in our expertise and our knowledge of the storytelling. To really, you know, that's also our job, is to guide them as well. Like, you know, to let them know that, you know, we're experts as well in this field. We're fans of it. And then just give our input as well. So we can help shape that. And the crazy thing is that when I started this, working in this industry, website design was like an afterthought. Like, anything digital was like, oh, no, the trailers. Obviously, it's the film's the meat, and that's everything. But it was like, oh, then we'll just give you the trailer. Here's some screenshots, and then here's like a really cool, like, downloadable wallpaper. You know, that's really what we were doing back then.
Right.
And it got more robust, and, you know, the past, like, you know, decade, it's just done a complete 180. Now the people who are actually working on these social campaigns they know the power of, like, social media, of, like, Facebook and Instagram, that we are actually teasing out and giving people first looks before, you know, any other section of that, you know, industry would be delivering that. You know, they know that we have access to, like, everyone on that social media platform. If it's Facebook, like, you know, we have that audience. And they also know the power of just someone who can retweet it to their network and it just can go viral. That we're actually now more at the forefront of, you know, just being a priority of, like, making sure that the social end is taken care of first, when we're just an afterthought. So it's really changed, and, like, the whole dynamic of working digitally has just become so fun, because I've always believed in it. I was doing, like, small sites for Reebok and Sony back in the day, but now it's just blown up. I mean, you have augmented reality now on your phones, and it's crazy what can be done.
You too, and they had augmented reality on their screens. It's like,
and it's all happening in the palm of your, you know,
I know,
your hand, and the phone is just incredible.
Now, besides your grandfather and your mother and your father being influences, who are some of your favorite artists that they were benchmarked for you to want to be an artist?
Trent Reznor.
Awesome. Good choice.
Yeah. And I think it's because I know that man takes on a ton of work on his own. Like, he does, you know, the arrangement, the conceptualization of an album, and then he goes and he has a band like kind of take his vision and perform that on stage.
Right.
Because I know I always knew that he was like, I'm not just going to go up there and hit a button on his computer. Like that's not how we're going to do it. So. He's actually evolved over the years and gotten, you know, like background singers, and he's done so many cool things in terms of pushing the envelope of multimedia.
Right.
I mean, he did this one thing where, you know, all the merch, the shirts that were sold at, like, you know, this Portugal show had all just capital letters throughout, like, their tour shirt, and that like spelled out like a URL going to like some really cool place where fans can get exclusive content.
Wow.
Like he released a few tracks, I guess USB, like, you know, and like one of the stalls, and like, you know, he would have fun with his fans, and yeah. He would also innovate. Like I heard there was actually a HBO special or a series that he was going to do for Year Zero, I think it was. So the guy's just,
he's on that
always
level.
Yeah, he's on
did
that
you see
level.
His tour where he did the visuals? It's, I mean, that blew my mind. I was like,
yeah.
This is changing the experience for the listener. It becomes, you know, like when you go see a concert, you're listening. Mm-hmm. And it's like a visual thing too, but he made it like this 4D experience where it was like, it was sonic, it was visual, it was like right in front of you, there was a texture to it. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was just kind of like mind-blowing. So we played Bonnaroo with Nine Inch Nails in 2009. And I got to watch Nine Inch Nails on the stage.
Oh, that's incredible.
It was amazing. And I got this crazy video footage of, like, behind the drummer. And, like, Trent would play these crazy guitar solos. And, like, it was like we were watching we were, like, on the stage. Like, it felt like we were performing and
yeah,
not
right?
doing anything. You know what I mean? But it was amazing to watch him lead this army of musicians and singers and pull off this. And I was like, man, this guy takes this so seriously. I respect it so much. And he continues to do that. He has, like, the best musicians playing with him. Pino Palladino, who's one of my favorite bassists. He played with him on his last tour. But the visuals were incredible. So, like, you saying that he's a major influence. I would have thought you were going to pick a visual artist. And I love that you picked somebody that's doing it, you know, in a multi-dimensional way, you know?
Absolutely. I mean, even what he did for his last ticket release is that he actually was like, okay, you guys are going to have to come down to the Palladium, you know, and you might have to talk to people and stand in line, interact with humans, you know, but the sale of the tickets are going to be where you have to line up and come to the venue like you used to do back in the day.
That's awesome.
So, yeah, so fans showed up, you know, I think it was Friday. I actually feel like I'm like the biggest poser now because I was supposed to go and I just other things came up on Friday, but we are now digesting our content in such a different way, and it's very cold, you know, just by tapping and
right,
you know, resharing.
You're
and
right on
one track hits, you know, there's no narrative anymore. That someone who actually, like, you know, can appreciate opening up a vinyl, like, and just like having the ritual of, like, like seeing
I still
the
look
artwork,
forward to that. That's like,
you know,
that
pulling
makes
it
my whole,
out,
yeah.
Placing it down, and putting the needle
that's
is
the best.
Like
that's the best.
It's a, you know, it's a workout.
I feel like millennials that don't know what that experience is. I'm like, dude, you don't even know the experience that you're denying yourself. It's just like when they show me a song on a cell phone. I'm like, no. Let me put it through this speaker system. Let's listen to it.
Yeah,
and
put on,
like,
headphones.
Yeah,
you know,
but
it's crazy.
And it's wild because we come from that generation where it's like, oh, you want to make it look cool? Oh, let's make it look cool. Oh, you want to make it sound cool? Let's listen to it on these crazy speakers. You know,
yeah.
I love that vinyl's coming back, but I also find that sometimes with millennials, it just kind of drives me crazy. They'll buy a vinyl and they'll listen to it on this, like, really dinky record player. And I'm like, you're not serving. That's like serving a Wolfgang Puck meal on
right.
Styrofoam plates. It's like, it just doesn't make sense. It's just... What are you
through
doing?
Through a Bluetooth speaker.
Yeah, right. So I respect what everything you're saying. It's just, yeah. it's right. This is why you're here. This is why we're friends, man.
Yeah, man. This is I have like, you know, your best sound system is going to be the one that you have on you. But when I'm at home, like, I have my setup where I have, like, you know, nice speakers. I got the receiver, and I don't want anything Bluetooth. I want it to be all connected through analog. That's just me. I just like that.
Yeah.
But, I also know I'm guilty. You know, also when you're in the car, you know, you don't have that. So
no, it's
Spotify's great.
I guess the convenience thing is always there because I'm guilty of it too.
Yeah.
Talk to me about this TV show that you're in development without giving away, you know.
Yeah.
Everything.
It's called Dark Haven, and it's something that I've worked on where I haven't pitched it yet. So I'm in development to put together the pitch Bible. And it was like my college thesis and something that I've always had in the back of my head, and the characters I could see so vividly. And, you know, it's essentially a sci-fi thriller that's in response to current day events. You know, it's the reaction of what happens 10 or 15 years based off of, happening now in politics and
that's
what's
amazing.
Happening now. So I'm trying to predict the future, but I'm also trying to do a fictional story based off that. So it's inspired by my love of animation, and actually I've drawn out all the characters, like they're and I've done a photo shoot where then I went to look for a, you know, guy that looked like my sketch, you know, like I did a poster of that, you know, and I had to make him like exaggerated, like his features, just to kind of like fit within that world. So because he's like this massive, like, you know, huge, like NFL linebacker guy who's a detective, and, you know, he's got a big trench coat. So I wanted to create this world, and I'm now putting together the pitch Bible for it. And the thing is that, you know, we pitch all the time for what we do during social media and our agency, that I'm taking all the things that we do and I'm trying to like cater it to this story. So it's, you know, sci-fi thriller. I'd love to have it on, you know, obviously everyone wants to have it something on Netflix and Amazon, but
well, it's possible. It's definitely possible.
Yeah, and I feel like we've pitched to Netflix before, and, you know, I know their style and what they like. You know, there is strategy, and, like, it's not going to go on Lifetime, you know?
Right, but
it definitely feels like, you know, if Spike was around, like, it'd have that, like, edginess. Like, FX seems to really, like, fit the vibe of the film or the series. I mean, I can go both ways. I want to be able to art direct the shit out of it, you know. I'm taking like the time to really do like the character posters and like create this vibe, you know. What does it look like at, you know, sundown versus, you know, like, you know, if they're in this warehouse, what's the lighting? And I'm just a big fan of like mocking something up and getting people excited about something before it's actually built, and that's helped me a lot in my career, just by able to just like get people excited of like, you know, here's one mood board, and that can like really be like, ah, that fits the vibe of what we're looking for, or that's like this is what I feel like this should be. So to be able to get my ideas quickly out on paper or, you know, JPEG has really helped me over the years. So I'm just kind of like now taking what I learned and applying it to this show that I want. And I've already had my expectations. So if nothing ever happens with it, it's a great portfolio piece of what I like and what I want to go down. Like,
well, don't think about it like that. Like, think that it will happen.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, that's everything, man. It's everything's about like putting it forward.
Yeah. I feel like this is like my baby. Like, I'm always trying to like just build myself up for, you know, someone could love it, and some people might be like, "Ah, just not for our network," you know. But if anything,
it'll find a home.
Yeah, I think it'll find a home somewhere. Like, even if I have to like shoot something myself, and, you know, it'll eventually become something that I'll be really proud of. That I, as an artist, you just want to get things out there and onto paper and onto video. So that to me is just fulfilling an artistic drive.
And you said it was your college thesis. Where did you go to school, and how did you come up with this thesis?
I went to Loyola Marymount University, just right by the marina.
That's right. So I read that in your bio.
Yeah, and
right.
I actually, you know, never thought I'd... I always knew I wanted to do art and design. I just never knew I'd be doing it here. I feel like there's, you know, the Silicon Valley is a place where kind of tech and design can kind of live together as one. And I feel like, you know, you can really make it now anywhere just with social media. You can have a fan base and show off your paintings and have an amazing audience on YouTube, you know. So it's like, it's not like I had to be here, but it definitely was nice to know that there were a lot of people who wanted to, like, go down and have that dream of being, you know, working with a big studio. And I wanted to be there, you know. I wanted to be here and do that. So I didn't think I'd still be here in LA, but I really love this. I love LA.
It's the best.
You know, like, there's
best
something,
weather.
Yeah, right? Like, people complain about the oddest things, but I'm like, man, I love this state, you know? Like, so, I mean, I used to live in London. I was there for a year.
It's
and I
dreary.
Did design work. And I realized that it's going to be a great experience if I just cap it right now and I just always have it. But if I would have lived there, I would have just taken it for granted and just been like going throughout my day existing. But now it was like, that's a really special time in my life because I left at the right time, like right in a good sweet spot. So yeah, but I love California.
What do you think is a big obstacle, like with creating something new, with pitching it to people that may not have that vision?
I think for me, it's going to be... Excuse me. I think for me, it's going to be... I've never been good on having to... As an artist, you just want to put something out there and not have to explain it. But there's a lot of times when you got to step in a room and it's the first time that these people who probably are just trying to find the next big thing, they don't know if they don't... It's not going to be that they like it, but like, does this fit the network that I'm at? You know? So you're trying to sell them on something. And I've never been someone to really properly... sell myself. Like, I'm not good at it. Like, for me to go out, like, when I was doing clothing line, we were trying to like promote our business, like just to get people like, hey, we're a new fashion company in LA, like come over here and check out our work. And I was like a little embarrassed to do that, you know. So I was like, I'm not good at it. You know, I just want to be able to like have something, put it out there, and people can interpret it how they want. But unfortunately, that's not the way that, you know, these big studios work. You know, you got to prove to them that you could do it. And you also have to get them excited about it. So, yeah, that's
I haven't even done it yet. I think every artist is kind of, they share that. There's like this cocoon that they feel like this is safe, and to sell it, mm-hmm. it infringes on other people.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, exactly.
But it's like the world needs it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
No, I know. I'm always going to stay true to that and know that, like, you know, this is something that I know people should see.
Well, I'm looking forward to it.
Thank you.
Where can people find you on Instagram?
Yeah, it's funny. You're like, where can people find you? And I was like, I don't even know what my handle is. I have to go check it.
No, that's
like,
good. I mean, honestly, I actually like that people aren't super social media. Like, when they give you 10 social handles, I'm like, I'm just not that guy. Like, I'm an artist, mm-hmm. so I have to, like, put stuff on Facebook, put stuff on Instagram, like... I have to. It's my role. If I'm not doing it, there's nobody else in my band that's going to be doing it. You know
that's
what I mean?
True.
So, but I mean, I get tired of it. Honestly, I have more fun just practicing, like arranging for shows and just coming up with ideas of like how I can kind of, you know, perform or do something in a way that's different. So I respect it when people are like not crazy about social media. So it's all good.
Yeah. I mean, for me personally, like, I haven't, like, the workflow has been, I've been very lucky, blessed, because it's been feeling, it felt natural. Like, everything that I've done so far has been, like, word of mouth. Like, a lot of my friends are like, oh, is he, it's usually like in any industry. It's like, oh, is he a good person? Does he do good work?
Yes.
As you know, like, you know,
that's everything.
You know, and that is huge. Because, you know, especially now if you go through recruiters and all that stuff, like, you know, you don't really know the person. But if you have a good friend of yours that you trust and they're like, he's a good guy and he'll get it done, that means everything in this industry.
Right. So, well, you are a good guy and you are an incredible artist.
Yeah.
Share your Instagram handle.
Instagram handle. It's A_Malzone.
Spell it out because people are dumb.
A_Malzone. Yeah.
Anthony, you are the man.
Thank you, man.
I'm going to have you back on the show.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Dude, it's cool. I've been so excited about this interview. I'm just like wondering what I was going to ask you about. I was like, don't spend the whole interview asking all about Prince. You got to be well-rounded. But literally, I mean, from the things that you talked about with fashion to the things you're doing with stage design to your college thesis becoming this reality for a TV series... I mean, it's endless, the possibilities, and I want to work with you more than just doing an interview, because I think you're such a creative mind, and I think great things are going to come from everything that you do, and I'm just a fan, so I'm going to have you back, but once again, A_Malzone for the Instagram.
That's it.
And for our listeners, we'll be back next week. Eddie should be here, and man... I'm inspired. So go out and make something. Make something, because that's what we like. All right, we'll see you here next week.